Good afternoon, everybody. This is Reverend Blake Ruby. Welcome to my show, The Church of the Soul's Evolution. I hope you're doing all right. Hope you had a good week. It's Saturday. Yesterday was my birthday. I'm 70 years old and one day. And today I'm going to talk about different subjects. I've been watching the Olympics. How about you? Have you been watching the Olympics? The U.S. is doing really well. It's got more medals than anyone else. The gold medal count is just about the same as China's. Last time I looked, the U.S. had 38 gold medals and China had 39. But overall, we're way ahead of everybody, about 30 medals, if you include the silvers and the bronzes. I was watching a little bit of the men's basketball game today, the final between USA and France. And even though I'm here in San Antonio and this is the hometown of Victor Wembanyama, I still was kind of rooting for the U.S., but if France had won, I wouldn't have been too disappointed. But I've got too much past times, years in the past, that I've supported LeBron and Steph and Kevin Durant to just change my mind all of a sudden and be 100% behind Victor Wembanyama. Although he's doing very good, and I'm so proud that he did well, and he's from San Antonio. He's with the Spurs, so I'm looking forward to a new year with the Spurs. And, you know, he got Rookie of the Year last year, and I think he's a fine young man. And I pray for his health, that he would stay healthy, for his wisdom, which would help him to stay healthy, of course. And I'm not sure if he'll lead the Spurs to a championship in the second year, but getting to the playoffs is realistic, and I'm looking forward to that. Possibly happening. I'm going to take a drink. Also, I've been watching track and field a lot. I'm a big track and field man. I go to the track just about every day to work out. And I've talked about that on previous radio shows, what I do, so that I might share what I've learned with you to tell you what I consider the best workout, one that will give you the right exercise for the heart and the lungs and not let you be injured. I think that's the best way of putting it. And this is something that I've learned from experience day after day, month after month, year after year. I'm 70 years old, and I started running when I was in the Army. Even before then, I took a course in junior college cross country. And, of course, growing up, you know, we played football, baseball. We used to run around, but not serious running. So I didn't really do serious running until I joined the Army for the first about 18 years, and then I got a profile because I donated one of my kidneys to my son back in 1995. I'll tell you a little bit about that here shortly. So I also found out in 1997 that I fractured my spine and misaligned my fourth and fifth lumbar vertebrae. Just telling you some facts here. I don't want to be negative, but I'm leading up to something here. And I'm doing okay. It was a hyperextension injury that happened slipping on ice. I think the first time it happened, I was about 3 years old, actually. I can't remember for sure. But falling outside of the house on ice, and my feet went up, and I came down, and I put up my right shoulder, right elbow to break my fall, and so that's how it happened. But I didn't actually realize that until 1997 when I had some x-rays done, because I felt something was wrong, so I looked into it, got the x-rays, had an MRI, I think I did back then. And found out that indeed I had fractured my spine and I had misaligned the fourth and fifth lumbar vertebrae. But I kept pushing on, and eventually I went to a board because I had a profile for, first I started with the sit-ups because, you know, the way the Army did sit-ups back then, and I don't think they still do it, and they've got a new test called the Combat Fitness Test, but back in the old days was the sit-ups, the push-ups, and the two-mile run. Well, the sit-ups, if you're familiar with the way it used to be done, and in the Army we used to do it a lot, you would have someone hold your feet, and then you would, you know, go all the way down with your hands behind your head, and then lift yourself up and touch your knees with your elbows, and you had to kind of come up so like your back was straight, you know, vertical to the ground. And I found out that that was giving me pain because of my back. I didn't know I had a back injury. So I got a profile from not having to do the sit-ups in 1997. And then I went back and I got a profile for doing push-ups, which is kind of not the same muscles, but interrelated. And then I went back, I got a profile for doing the run. So when you get a profile for all three events of the PT test, then they send you to a medical review board, which they did, and I stood in front of them, and they said, well, don't you want to keep on running? You know, we could prescribe, you can get anti-inflammatory drugs prescribed to you. And I said, no, I don't want to because I'm worried about my kidney. I only have one kidney, and I don't want to take that kind of medication in case it is detrimental to my kidney's health, you know. Anyway, so that was around 2000, and then I was walking, especially after the kidney donation. I used to walk all the time. That's what they prescribed doing. So I was an avid walker almost right away. The first 30 days after the kidney donation, my side, because back in 1995, they didn't have the less invasive surgery than compared to now. They opened up my right abdominal area there around the waist. It was about a 9-inch scar, and took the kidney out and gave that to my son, who was 10 months old at the time, and put that in his abdominal, right in the middle, in his abdominal area. You know, the kidney is about the size of your fist. And even a baby, it fit in there pretty well, you know. And he was 10 months old. He weighed about 18 pounds. So it worked out. And it lasted him 19 years. But more on that later. Going back to running, then after walking, I was getting tired of that. Also looking for something that would exercise my heart faster and more thoroughly than walking, you know, and something that would exercise my lungs better. So around 2012, 13, I started doing a little bit of running. Started out with doing 1 mile runs, and then I got into sprinting. And to tell you the truth, since about 2014, 2015, up until now, I've done hundreds and hundreds, maybe even over 1,000 100-meter sprints. I'm talking about, you know, try as hard as you can. And maybe not all the time, 100%, but close to it. And I felt that that was helping me because you do the research, and you look on the internet, they say that sprinting is the best exercise you could do. High-intensity training doesn't take a lot of time. You know, it's better than going on a 5 or 10 mile run. You can get the same benefits. It exercises the heart better than no other exercise. It exercises the lungs, and it stimulates the human growth hormone, so it'll keep you young. Maybe that's why people told me I look so young, besides being a vegan, mostly vegan, eating only vegan foods with a little bit of dairy or eggs, you know, food products that have a little bit of both in them. But basically, I'm about 98-99% vegan. But the sprinting also, and the sprinting also was helping me to stay young. But then I was in a quandary as to, okay, where am I going to exercise? Is it going to be on the pavement? Is it going to be on the concrete? Over the years, I was trying even, there's a dirt track on Lackland Air Force Base I was using. And the rubber track, I thought, well, the rubber track, they say, is best because the impact is less. When you're sprinting especially, the impact is a pretty major consideration. But I found out after all the years that I didn't really like, as I got older, I didn't like going around in circles. I was getting bored with that, and it's also seeming to hurt me in some way. So although I've always done a lot of research, always checking what other people do, what they feel, their routines, a lot of research, a lot of reading, and I found out, I don't know if it's true or not, I'm not a medical professional, but they say that when you go around in a circle on a rubber track, the rubber on the shoes doesn't, because of the rubber on the track, doesn't allow full rotation of the knees. And when you're young, you can probably not notice it, you know, but do it thousands of times over the years, and maybe eventually later on in life, you might start having some problems with the hips and the knees, you know. So that played into consideration in my mind. And I came up with a workout, which I mentioned on a previous radio shows, to just use the straightaway on the track, one of the straightaways. And I've come up with a routine that really provides me, in my opinion, a sufficient and satisfactory workout. And I would just, it's just like taking that straightaway and doing sprints and walking back, doing it again, you know, 100-meter sprints, sometimes shorter, maybe 60, 50. But then I was having some hamstring injuries and groin injury, and I figured out something was wrong. I'm trying on my best to get my form right, and they say that form is important, you know, starting off in the right foot. I was trying everything I knew so I could keep it up, but there was something that was not quite right about it. So I looked into the problems that people have been having and similar problems like plantar fasciitis in the feet and groin injuries and hamstring injuries. And I came up with the idea that a lot of people have one leg that's longer than the other. It's called leg length discrepancy. Also, and not surprisingly so, one of the legs is stronger than the other. Usually the right leg stronger than the left leg. So if you have all of these sprints that a person does, like me, day after day, month after month, year after year, it's going to show in ways like, besides those injuries, also I was getting a popping in my left ankle and knee problems, back, creaks, you know, like aches in my joints, aches and pains. Well, I had been doing this kind of a little bit over the last few years. Not much, just kind of every once in a while. I found out that running backwards is actually a pretty popular thing all around the world, in China and Europe. There are groups of people who are dedicating themselves to running backwards as a means to get over injuries caused by forward running. The rationale behind backwards running is that it's easier on the joints. There's less impact. Of course, you can't run as fast as you can forwards, but also, if you note that when the feet hit the ground, you're putting equal distribution on both feet, and you're pushing off of the toes. So the leg length discrepancy isn't as prevalent when you're going backwards. And there are some people that have set the world record for running a backward mile, like in about just a little under 6 minutes. So there's a 13 point something second 100 meter run backwards by this one man. And they have these races in Europe. They're trying to get them into the Olympics as a sport, but they haven't done it yet. Realistically, and in my opinion, it is a valid thing to consider. And I think it would be not only interesting, it would be kind of hilarious too, to watch that. And the thing is, it's beneficial. It doesn't tear the body down as much. The impact, and that's the main thing always when running or sprinting, impact is the most important thing to consider as to why your body might be having aches and pains. So I appeal to the Olympic Committee for 2028 in L.A. because there's a lot of people out there advocating for backwards running. You can see a lot of interesting videos on YouTube about the subject if you're interested. And want to listen to a logical, rational kind of way of explaining why it's beneficial and why so many people like it. It's been going on for years now. So there is something behind it. You just can't shoo it aside saying, that's ridiculous. You have to give it a try. Put your faith in the people that have been trying it, like me, for example. And my goal now is to keep it up. Last 2 days, I've gone out to the track and I've ran 50-meter sprints, six yesterday, six today. And breathing through my nose, too, that's another thing that was a consideration. Because breathing through, you should be, when you're doing strenuous exercise, unless you're running a marathon, it'd be almost impossible, although the most famous, the most successful, well-known marathon runner in the world, Eliud Kipchoge, the one who broke the two-hour barrier. This man is like the best. He's the GOAT for marathon runners. And if you study him, like I have a little bit, you will notice that he breathes mainly through his nose. Even at the end of a marathon, he'll cross the finish line breathing through his nose. There's something to it, my friends. And so I've been working on that now for the last few months, just concentrating on breathing through my nose. But eventually, you know, you have to take some breaths in through your mouth. The question is oxygen intake. You know, how much oxygen intake do you need? But if you do the research on the internet, they say that when you breathe in through your nose, the oxygen actually that comes in through your nose replenishes the cells in a more effective way than breathing through the mouth. And also, when you do a lot of mouth breathing, it gets to sleep apnea and sleep issues. So go figure. If you don't believe me, check it out yourself on the internet. You have to always question everything. Don't just accept what I tell you for granted, you know, and that it's the truth. So I'm constantly involved with this. Good workout running backwards, I say actually, that it's the equivalent of running 100 meters backwards is the equivalent of running 1,000 meters forwards. It's a better workout for the heart and therefore the system. And it gives you a different perspective too. Instead of looking at what's in front of you, you're looking behind you as you're running backwards. And check it out. It's something I hope to keep up, you know. And it also will straighten your back out. It's a good workout for the abdominal area, you know. So if you're looking to lose some belly fat, consider it. I've seen some people on the track do a little bit of backward, either walking or running. I've got a good friend who likes to backward walk, and that's a pretty popular thing too. So if you're really serious about finding out the truth in regard to physical activity and what's more beneficial, and so that you won't get injured when you do it, look on the internet or look on YouTube. Just type in, find out. Seek the truth, my friends, and the truth will set you free. Anyway, changing the subject to the Olympics. So I'm a track and field guy because I work out on the track all the time. I'm going to take a drink. I'm very interested in the USA's track and field team, mainly the 100 and 200 meter people. Noah Lyles, you've heard that name, I'm sure. He won the 100-meter gold at the Olympics. He was the 100-meter champion at the World Championships last year. He's been the 200-meter champion. And right after he won the 100-meter gold medal in Paris, he came down with COVID. Really unfortunate because he's had a history of asthma. But he's such a fine young man, very intelligent and very strong, and the what I would consider the logical successor to the legacy of Usain Bolt. Usain Bolt won three Olympics in a row, the 100 meter, the 200 meter, and the 4x100 meter, although one was taken away because of doping finding for one of his teammates, not him, but someone else. So he only had 8 gold medals. He should have had 9. And the Olympic Committee, I don't know if I trust everything they say. I do question some of the things that they do. But anyway, Usain Bolt, if you study him, you know, he has run the fastest 100-meter run, 9.58 seconds. 200-meter, 19.9 seconds. So he is the GOAT. And I've got a little advice for Noah Lyles out there. We all love him. We love his spirit. But I would give him this advice. The next time that you compete, which will probably be next year, save your energy. Don't go jumping up and down and with the crowd, trying to get the crowd all worked up. Take a look at Usain Bolt, what he did. He was funny and he got the crowd going, but he would make gestures. He would save his energy. That's the thing I want to say to Noah. Save your energy. It could help you when you run the race. That's more important to run the race, not show off or get the fans worked up. You know, study Usain Bolt, what he did. You don't have to do the same thing, but something similar, where you get the crowd worked up and you're not expending a lot of energy. Then work on, now that you probably only won the bronze medal, you know, and he was hoping to get the gold and break that record, first U.S. sprinter in 40 years to get a double 100-meter, 200-meter gold medal. He didn't do it. He got the bronze in the 200-meter. So work on breaking the record. That would be my advice also, which is for him, he got down to 1931, which was the same as Michael Johnson got in the 1996 Olympics, I think. And so Usain Bolt's best time was 1919, and then Johan Blake, his Jamaican teammate, did the 200 meters in 1926 one time. So look to try to break Johan Blake's record first. Get under 1926, either tie it or beat it. That would be my challenge to Noah for next year, to get his mind back into it, get a great victory by being the second fastest man in history in the 200 meter. And also keep trying to improve yourself in the 100 meter to get down to, I think his best time, he did 979 in the 100 meter. And so try to get down into the 9.6s. You know, Usain Bolt did 9.69 one time, 9.63. I think that was at the 2012 Olympics in London. Tyson Gay, a U.S. sprinter, also ran a 9.69. So those are the only two sprinters that got that have gotten underneath 9.7. I think Noah Lyles can do it because he's got that same tall frame that Usain Bolt has. Once you get that good start, and he's learned to do that recently to improve his start. But once he gets that good start, he knows that he has to spread his legs out, and that's how he's going to beat everybody, just like Usain Bolt did in the last 50 meters by just opening up a gate and letting his legs just take him to victory, so to speak. Noah Lyles can do that too because he's tall and he can do that like Usain Bolt did. So that would be my advice for Noah Lyles. I don't want to dampen his spirit, but my friend, save your energy. You know, all this bouncing around, jumping around, other people, yeah, your competitors are looking at you like, you know, shaking their heads like Arian Knighton did when Noah Lyles ran out there for the 200 meter. He was trying to whip up the crowd and jumping up and down, and he shook his head kind of like, no, something wrong with that. You know, save your energy, man. Just your way to the crowd. Maybe come up with something like Usain Bolt did. He did the Bolt, you know, where he put his arm out, pointing the left arm and pulled the right arm back. And that was the Bolt. That was the trademark of Usain Bolt. And what a great man he was. My God. There'll never be another one like him. That's what the sprinters out there, the future sprinters, have to, and who they have to emulate. Try to be as good as he was. Three Olympics in a row, 100 meter, 200 meter gold. That's not going to be beaten, I think, ever, in my opinion. All right, changing the subject. I wanted to talk a little bit about my kidney donation in 1995. My problem is, when I retired in 2004, I had a retirement physical with the Army. And when you have the retirement physicals, and they tell you before you retire, you go to what they call ACAP. So it's a transition program to help you transition from the military to civilian life. They tell you, you served your country for 20 plus years. I did 22 years in the Army. And you deserve as much disability as you can get for what you did. Because a veteran, if you haven't heard this before, is someone who at one point in their life signed a blank check to the U.S. government up until everything and including their life, taking their life. In combat, I did the first 4 years in the infantry, so I could have been sent to Grenada, and that was around that time. I could have gone to Panama, but the first 4 years I did was 82 through 86, so I could have been in Grenada. There had been another conflict around the world. They needed a mortar platoon, which is what I was in, a mortar platoon, 81 millimeter and four deuce, 107 millimeter. They could have sent me with my platoon, and I could have got killed. You know, our platoon could have got wiped out, but it didn't. I'm just saying, that's what a veteran is, someone who puts his life on the line, offers his life to Uncle Sam, and says, I will serve, and you can do what you want with me. Send me to war. I will fight for you and even die for you. That's what a veteran is. I served 22 years, 4 years in the infantry. So they tell you before you retire, try to get as much disability as you can. And so then you look at, okay, what's wrong with me? Do I have sleep apnea? I should have been checked for sleep apnea back then because they didn't tell me that I needed to include all of these things later on. I found out, you know, that I could have done that in my retirement physical, but no one said, hey, you need to get checked for sleep apnea. You might have it, and you can get disability for that. And they didn't tell me about other things, too, that I've been having to fight for over the years afterwards. So that's a major point of contention there with the VA back then in 2004. They didn't tell veterans, people getting ready to retire with over 20 years of service, hey, you need to do this now. You need to get everything checked out. Try all these conditions. Tinnitus in the ear. And me, I had my what is called the right donor nephrectomy, 1995. I donated one of my kidneys to my son because he was born in May of 94. And we knew right away that there was a problem. I was overseas. I came home. I saw him like about 4 days after he was born. He had underdeveloped kidneys. In other words, during fetal development, there was a blockage in the ureter causing the urine to back up and stunt the growth of the kidneys. So when he was born, his kidneys were underdeveloped, and the doctor said, well, he's going to need dialysis and transplantation. So that was a bit of a shock, but it was also an amazing thing to see my son, you know, as a baby, my only child. I never thought that I would have a baby, a son. And it was a blessing, a true blessing. When I first saw him, I looked across the room, and there he was, and I was so proud. I was, like, blown away. I've got a son. Oh my God. And so we went into that mode that we needed to be in to help him to survive. My ex-wife, she couldn't donate one of her kidneys because she had kidney disease in her family. Your father died of kidney disease at age 44, so maybe it's no surprise that Bryce kind of had kidney disease when he was born, you know, or better put, during the fetal development, a little bit of that interrupted his growth in the normal way, if you know what I mean. So they looked at me and I said, well, of course, I'll donate one of my kidneys. What do I need to do? So I had to be tested for compatibility. The blood type was right. I was O positive. He was, I think, A negative, but O positive is a universal donor, So I went through the cell compatibility testing, and I was found to be a match. So then we had to go through at age 3 months, so around the August-September timeframe, 1994, doctors took out his kidneys and put him on peritoneal dialysis. And he was on dialysis for 7 months. So during that time, we had to make sure that he had to get fattened up, so to speak, to achieve the minimum weight for a transplant, which is 18 pounds. Also, the age minimum is 6 months. So that was going to be okay. We had to schedule the transplant in advance, you know, because we just can't do it right away. It has to be like months down the road. Plus, he had to get to that minimum weight. And it was a very stressful time for my ex-wife and me because when he was on peritoneal dialysis, we took him up. You know, he was a baby. Each nighttime. And also, he had a tube through his nose, which pumped, high-calorie formula was being pumped into his stomach from a machine so that it would fatten him up because he was throwing up all the time. And that's pretty common with people that have kidneys that don't work properly. They throw up a lot. And so Bryce was vomiting during the day and night. And at nighttime, we had the alarms of the dialysis machine and the what they call the NG machine, nastrogastrin. I forget what it's called exactly, but it's got to do with the the nose and the stomach. And he would pull the tube out of his nose, and not surprisingly, because it hurt him, And then we'd have to stick it back in his nose, and that was not an easy task. And so then that all that formula would be over his bed sheets and blankets, and we'd have to replace the bed sheets and blankets maybe once, twice, three times a night. And so we didn't get a lot of sleep with all the alarms going off and him crying. And it was a stressful time, but he pulled through. He was a real champ, you know, a fighter. And, you know, even today, he's a fighter. He's tough. Well, he's been through a lot. He got a second kidney back in 2014. His best friend's mom in Ohio. That was a true love gift. Me as a father, it's kind of expected. But this mother of his best friend gave him another kidney in 2014 at the University of Michigan. I was there for the surgery, and he's had that kidney ever since. So he just went over 10 years on the 2nd of July. Going back to how stressful it was from age 3 to 10 months, 7 months, we went through that. And the transplant list, to get on the transplant list, and we put him on the transplant list, is not a guaranteed thing. It was the same back then as it is now, about 5 years for a kidney. And according to the internet, about 50% of all babies make it to renal transplant, you know. So there was a 50% chance that you might not make it. That's according to recent studies. Back in 1995, you know, the medical technology was different, so the chances of surviving nowadays are better. So, because my wife, going back to my wife not being able to do it, I did it because it was a morally right thing to do. And so on the 29th of March, 1995, at Stanford University, we went through the operation, the surgery. And they took out my right kidney and put it in him, and it worked very well for 19 years. For a cadaver, poor family related, or from poor kidney from a family member, the life expectancy of the kidney is more than just a plain cadaver, like someone who had died or someone who donated a kidney to another person. Anyway, so the VA said that it was elective surgery, and therefore they decided not to grant any disability for the loss of a kidney. Well, I told a lawyer about that back around 2018-19, and he said, I think we can win because not only the disabilities associated with the kidney donation, and there are some which I won't get into, but for the loss of the kidney itself, there's rationale that we haven't really started to get into it with the VA. You know, I think that right now at this time there is a VA judge examining the case. They reopened it, the right donor nephrectomy claim, in other words, the kidney donation claim, because we said that it shouldn't be considered elective surgery. By definition, elective surgery means any surgery that is not an emergency or not urgent that can wait and be scheduled at a time further down the road. Well, the kidney transplant situation with Bryce was very urgent because I had to donate a kidney to him in order to save his life. That's the bottom line. Because, as I mentioned, kidney transplant list is 5 years, waiting 5 years. Between when the child is born, the baby is born, until 2 years, the survival rate is 50%. Now, just push that out to 5 years. And all of what we were going through with the dialysis and, the situation at nighttime with the machines and the alarms going off, we couldn't have waited for a kidney transplant from someone else, you know. I mean, a kidney from someone else. So also the Medicare and Medicaid calls kidney transplants a high urgency operation, a tier 3B. So kidney transplantation is an urgent operation. And therefore, not elective. So what do you think, my friends? Do you believe it was elective, or do you believe it was mandatory or kind of necessary for me? Now, when I think of elective surgeries, I think of maybe some kind of removing something from the skin, or a vasectomy, or maybe eye surgery. But I had to have it approved by the top, the very highest leadership in the Army, the Surgeon General of the Army. Of course, I had to have my commander approve it, my first sergeant. But also the Surgeon General of the Army, and they said in the memorandum to me where they approved it, they said, we want to wish your son, they didn't say me, they said, we want to wish your son, because I did it for him, right? Your son, you and your family, the best in this stressful situation. And we hope the surgery goes well. So everything considered, my friends, I would say that the surgery wasn't elective. It was necessary for me in order to save my son's life. So that's the difference. And that's what we are fighting, if you will, with the VA about. Just FYI, I just thought I'd mention that to you. And then there are the disabilities. I'll mention that in case you're thinking about donating a kidney to someone, and it's a very noble thing to do. Please, I would recommend it. The surgery nowadays are less invasive, so you won't have a big scar on your side like I have. I've already been granted 10% disability for the scar on my right side. And that's another thing that I was going through experiencing, going back to talking about the sprinting and the running. Because having that scar on my side is and has been affecting the rotation of my torso when I run. It took years for me to figure out, you know, that, hey, why do I have like this little inner tube on my right side in my abdominal area? That's where the scar is, a 9-inch scar. So the running backward actually allows that equal distribution of weight on the feet rather than running forward, which was aggravating my right side. And therefore, other parts of my body, like my left ankle, left knee, my shoulders. Anyway, another disability that I have is the gastroesophagus reflex disease, you know, where the stuff comes up from the bile comes up from the stomach into the throat. And I had that occasionally, but more than that, it's the loss of a kidney. I'm not a doctor, but I know that if you donate a kidney, your digestive system is going to be a little bit compromised. I mean, we're meant to have two kidneys. I mean, we can survive on one kidney. And people do live a normal life with one kidney. I knew my ex-wife's aunt and uncle. We used to visit them all the time when I would go and visit Bryce, because he moved up to Ohio with my wife. We separated about a few months after the transplant. And we had a very stressful time together, and that's why I think we finally separated, what we went through. And I've noticed that other people, when they go through stressful times together, like family, children who have medical conditions, it pushes them to the limit as far as their patience is concerned. So we split up. She took him up to Ohio to live with family and friends, and I would visit him like once a month. We got divorced in 1998, a few years later. And so I used to visit him once a month, and we would have a great time. Always did. And we go and see Aunt Blanche at the end of the day. Video games of miniature golf. We would throw the football around, throw the baseball around, go to a batting cage, run around the malls, take pictures of ourselves, play more video games, go out and eat together, go to the movies. And so we had a ball, and then we'd go visit Aunt Jerry and Uncle Jerome. And they were a really cool elderly couple that used to take us in. We'd get there usually around 7 o'clock in the evening. We'd always watch Lawrence Welk and Bad Boys. And then I would take him home because the divorce agreement said that I could keep him until 9 o'clock at night, and then I'd have to turn him over to my ex-wife by 9 o'clock. This is what I usually did. And Aunt Jerry had one kidney. She lost one of her kidneys when she was around 40 years old, and she lived to be in her mid-80s before she passed away. God bless her soul. What a beautiful woman she was. And so there's proof that people can live normal life with one kidney. But you have to be careful. One thing I noticed after I donated the kidney was that I had to reevaluate my diet because I was concerned about my longevity. I didn't want to do anything that would hamper my living to be a ripe old age, you know, because I'd like to live to be 100 years old. Who doesn't? I know some people are upset at this world and know that it's a very hard place to live, but to live to be 100 years old, that is, well, I think, what most people strive for, you know? And there's still a lot of research that has to be done on kidney donation because it's a relatively new thing, you know, the procedure. I think the first kidney donation was done back in the 60s or maybe even the 50s. And so there's not a lot of long-term research about the longevity of donors or people who receive kidneys, recipients. And if you're thinking about donating a kidney to someone, it is a true gift of life, and I would encourage it. Yes, there are some changes in your body that I've experienced, and I'm telling you that you would experience them. But if you're going to save the life of someone, that is what I consider to be a beautiful thing to do, putting their life above your own. Yes, you can live normally with one kidney. You will have to make some changes, yes, in your lifestyle, in your diet, in your exercise. It'll be painful. For me, it took me about a month to get that feeling of my right abdominal area. All the nerves were severed when they cut me from one side to the other. That 9-inch scar severed all the nerves, and it was like a board on the right side. So I was walking, and it felt like I had a board on my right side. And then it took years to get feeling back into the nerves in that right abdominal area. But now with the surgeries being less invasive, you can survive, you know, and not suffer all that pain that I suffered. So what I was saying was that with two kidneys, God, the Creator, did not make a mistake by giving you two kidneys. The fact that you can survive, that we can survive on one, is a blessing, you know, because you take one away, the other one gets up in size, it increases in size and is able to do the duty of two kidneys by itself. So the GERD, that was something the VA granted me, 10%, which, as I said, stands to reason that your digestive system, which the kidneys are a part of, are a little bit compromised. Not the same. You know, the kidneys have to deal with the digestive system, digestion for both fluids and solid food, you know. And what else besides the GERD? besides the painful scar, fatigue, I would say there is an increase in fatigue that I didn't experience before. I used to be a hard charger. I would get a maximum score on the PT test for the push-ups and sit-ups. And the run, 2 mile run, I was always able to run under 12 minutes. I mentioned to you that I went and got profiles for the sit-ups and the push-ups and eventually the run. I think it was because I no longer had the desire to push myself to the limit because I had donated one of my kidneys because I had only one kidney in my body. And it might have instead been the result of the fatigue that is associated with a kidney donation. And I don't know the medical explanation for that. It might just be, you know, when you try to bust your butt, so to speak, to max the push-ups and the sit-ups and the PT tests and the two-mile run, you just no longer have that desire to. It might be also because of the scar on my side, you know. But now with surgeries being less invasive, maybe that fatigue wouldn't really factor in for someone nowadays that wanted to donate one of their kidneys. So I would always recommend it. My son Bryce might need another kidney in the future. I might need a kidney. You know, I'm trying my best to do the right thing always. I consider myself a highly intelligent person, wise. I've reached age 70 and I still continue to thrive and survive, you know, one day at a time. Yes, I have sleep apnea issues, and that's another thing, too, that might be related. I was granted PTSD by the VA for the kidney donation. And what I was mentioning also, having to survive and having that desire to enhance my longevity and worrying about what to eat and what to drink, the VA psychologist that they sent me to see agreed with me, and also independently without me actually trying to sway their opinion, that it stands to reason that it is logical that someone that donates one of their kidneys might suffer from some kind of anxiety afterwards. Don't you think? Is that reasonable? Is that logical? Because you might be worried about your longevity where, you know, it might decrease your lifespan, in other words. But still, I would do it again today, my friends. But don't just take it from me. Do your own research. If you're thinking about donating a kidney to someone, read. Read as much as you can on the subject. Look in the internet. Find books. But know that, there is nothing like a real kidney, my friends. It's better than dialysis. I can't stress that enough. All right, I've got just a few seconds left. Thank you for listening. I know I didn't talk about spirituality that much, but I hope you got something valuable out of this time. And thank you. I love you. May the creator of the universe bless us and watch over us and protect us. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.